Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're back for part two of the discussion of the defense against the Bengals. Joining me for that again is Matt Ruff. Matt, how you doing?
Doing great. Happy Thanksgiving to all. Sad that we had a loss, but looking forward to discussing some of the individual performances on the defense.
Yeah, it's a really good defensive effort, particularly before they became completely worn out in that fourth quarter. Wasted in this one. I mean, the defense looked great in that first quarter after the first seven plays, as we mentioned, and we talked about the streakiness in the first quarter. They really had a great first half.
Yeah, talked about the fact that the defense had to play 80 snaps. Kyle Hamilton played every snap, which is not something you want to see. Also talked about Joe Burrow and, you know, where he overperformed or underperformed, and the fact that, you know, the fact that he kept that offense moving and didn't put the ball in harm's way was a huge benefit for the Bengals.
I think they certainly did well with that. We also talked about the packages. The big nickel has been extremely effective since they've gone to that. I do not foresee any way they leave that, but that's one question we didn't really talk about. It's brought up pretty much on a weekly basis is, can the Ravens afford to stay with big nickel when the player who's the linchpin of that might not be durable enough to stay on the field if you keep doing it? And what are your feelings about that?
Yeah, I think that Hamilton is one of those players that has concerned me from his first year, where he would come in and out of the game often with some minor injuries. And I think that over his career, he's definitely been someone to, you know, be in and out with minor injuries. I think that playing him close to the line of scrimmage is a cheat code, or maybe like the queen on the chessboard. But I really do worry about the long-term durability, which is why I proposed, hey, should he put on some more weight to bulk up, or do you lose some of the benefit you get there?
By the way, I noticed that the announcers for the game called Hamilton the ace of spades at slot corner. And that's come from one place, folks. Didn't come from anywhere else but this show. So thank you for listening to my show. I do appreciate it. Anyway, I'm sure there's other people who have used that terminology, but I definitely came up with it independently, so I'm happy about that. Okay. Anyway, lots of other stuff to listen to that first episode. So some strange activations we talked about. I spent a little bit of time on the activation of Carl Lawson and Aeneas Peebles, in particular Peebles getting four snaps in a game that ends up being the way it did, such a slog for the defense playing 80 snaps. It's tough to have a defensive lineman only plays four snaps amid that and what that does for the rest of your guys in terms of rotation.
Yeah, for sure. And if you look at the snap counts, you know, CJ Okoye, he only played 16 snaps. Aeneas Peebles, like you said, four snaps. Keon Martin, one snap. So there's definitely some interesting activations that they had here, but the defense got tired.
Yeah, good game for the defense, generally speaking. They played well enough to win. I think that's fair to say, and I don't think they'd have given up 32 points had they not given up the offense basically not given up a average of a 47-yard line of starting field position. It's their own 47, but still the 47-yard line for the Bengals. So tough game. They played their hearts out, and they did not get it done in the end. We always start off the second part of the show talking about individual players, Matt, and you're the guest. Who would you like to talk about first?
All right. So I think it's always makes sense to start with the biggest player, because I've got a thing for the biggest players on the team. So John Jenkins would be my first person to go with. When they signed him in the offseason, I was shocked when I looked up his age, and I was shocked to see how much he played the previous season or two with the Raiders. I think that John Jenkins has been a fine addition to the team. He always makes a play or two a game, getting into the backfield. And I'm really happy the Ravens have him. I would prefer if he was lower on the snap count rotation and wasn't relied upon as much. And I would like to see the Ravens next year get a player similar to John Jenkins, but maybe just a little bit lesser in age. And have it be someone who can, rotate in on a few more snaps. But I thought John Jenkins has really done a good job on this team. He did have a screen pass that he kind of got eaten up on. But, you know, when you're 350, 60 plus pounds, I mean, after Thanksgiving could be more than that. I thought he's at least provided some really valuable snap eating on this defense.
Yeah, Voss and I have talked about him a little bit on Friday Morning GM, and you know, he's a player I would not be averse to the Ravens re-signing. If there's one player you can last, one place where you can last a long time, it's at nose tackle, and we haven't really seen a huge drop off in his play, and he's playing a lot of snaps in the middle of that defense. He played 365 snaps this year, and that's through 12 games, so that's 30 per game. So he's on pace for about 510. That'll actually be less than he had each of the last 2 years with Las Vegas. So it's not like the Ravens are relying on him tremendously. And I think they found kind of a niche value to him, yeah, is that you can play him at the one tech and move Travis Jones to the three tech, particularly in early downs, and have a pretty potent pass rush duo there. You get a nice opportunity. I always wanted them to do that with Michael Pierce and Travis Jones. They never really did, not more than a handful of snaps. You know, certainly they played some jumbo snaps together. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about in your regular kind of nickel defense when you put those two guys on the field. And they would always have them separated because they had pairings, and they had, you know, they didn't want to use both their nose tackles on the same play, because then, you know, that's using up snaps from them, if you want to talk about it that way. But with Jenkins and Jones, and, you know, still having Okoye around after them, it's made a big difference in terms of Jones's productivity these last few weeks.
All right, Ken, your turn.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's go to Travis Jones, since we're talking about him anyway. Had another really solid game. Three pressures plus another late QH. So it wasn't within 3 seconds, but anytime you knock down Joe Burrow, you can put me down for that one, even if it's an ATS play, which it was, unfortunately. Had 5 defensive wins among his 6 tackles. We talked about a method to do that, by the way, in that first episode. Go back and take a listen to that if you want to hear exactly how you do that with just your control F in the game book to find those plays. And then, of course, that forced fumble and fumble recovery from, was that P. Ryan? I think it might have been P. Ryan.
Yep.
With 5 minutes or so left, gave the Ravens that last little bit of hope while a lot of people were on the way to their cars.
Yeah, I would like to see what's going to happen with Travis Jones at the end of the year. Terrified to think of what would happen to this defense without him. He really is the heart and soul up the middle of the defense, and, you know, enables Hamilton and Roquan to be playmakers, and you know, the rest of the defense to do their thing. I thought Travis Jones really had a solid game. I think that, I don't know how often Jones has a truly game-changing game, but he has a lot of very solid games, which if you can pitch a lot of very solid games, that gets you pretty high up in my book. So very impressed with what we've seen from Travis and the consistency. A little worried about some of the injury history with him. He's definitely missed some games over time. And I wonder what it's going to take for the Ravens and for Jones to come to an agreement, because I think Jones is going to be in demand. I don't think he's going to take much of a discount. He wasn't, you know, a first round pick. There's no hometown discount coming here. So are the Ravens going to pony up to keep someone like Travis Jones, or do they risk losing him and really trying to reshape some of this defense in the offseason?
I think, I don't know if the Ravens can sell this, by the way, in terms of hometown discounts, but it does seem like Ronnie Stanley was the player who took a little bit of a hometown discount this last offseason. There's a certain value that some players may put on the lore of being universally beloved for the rest of your life in that city. And you get it if you win your team a Super Bowl. You get it if you play for a team for 8 or 9 years and it's the same people that, even though they're now 65 and 70 years old, that you're coming back to trot out with that shield around, you know, in front of the crowd. There's a certain value to that. And, you know, there's a lot of things in life money won't buy you. And that's a really nice thing to have. Of course, you know, faced with a decision of $8 million or that, people are usually going to take the $8 million. I do understand it. I'm not putting it down. I'm just saying I wish more players would consider it as a factor. If, you know, certainly when if you're trying to decide a tie, I don't think there's any decide a question about it. But I already think players don't like to move to start with. I think they prefer, generally speaking, to stay in a city. If it's, you know, if it's a generally nice cosmopolitan city, most NFL cities are. You know, Buffalo might be an exception. Is that people don't want to necessarily live there. I've heard that Willis McGahee said that very famously, but But otherwise, I think, you know, most cities, people generally like the food and the climate is okay, and the nightlife is probably pretty good and whatnot. So yeah, I would think Travis Jones would, you know, that might be something that would be okay for him. And I certainly hope he's back. Let me just put it that way.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So next player, CJ Okoye. I was hoping to see Okoye being able to shoulder more snaps at this point in the season, though I'm not saying it was likely or you know, he hasn't met expectation. But I'm glad he's getting to play every week, and that he's getting to play against different body types, different schemes, etc. But, you know, only being able to play 16 snaps in a game in which the defense of the Ravens played 80, you know, he played less than Brent Urban, for example. Just be hoping someone at his age and stature could be able to play a little bit more than that.
Yeah, so they played 147 snaps among the defensive linemen. He only played 16 of them. Actually, I think it was 151. So anyway, he played 11% of the snaps in the game, and that's just not very exciting. The Ravens have played a lot of two nose tackle, which has been accommodating to who he is. Mm-hmm. He's been on the field a lot. He actually was paired up with Urban on most of his snaps in this game. So Urban also played some uncovered nickel to get a third defensive lineman in there, but a lot of it was just paired up with Urban in the game. I don't have a problem that they want Jenkins and Jones on the field together more, and I don't have a problem that they want Jones only on the field when it's a pass rush down and they want to figure out how to fill in with outside linebackers or inside linebackers around him to try and put up a formidable rush. But it does seem to me like Okoye playing more downs in a game like this would have been appropriate.
Yeah. Do you know why they're not playing him more, Ken? Do you see what you could think of the big flaw would be? I know he can't set his feet very well yet. He's still kind of working on the footwork. But is there something that jumps out to you as to why Okoye, you know, I wouldn't think it'd be unreasonable for him to play maybe 27 or 28 snaps in this type of game.
So since week 6 against LA, and this takes the whole winning streak into account because that started the next week in Chicago, he hasn't played more than 18 snaps in any game. But part of that is that the Ravens have been doing better in relative snap count over that period. The Cincinnati game is the first game that they were, again, got absolutely smeared like a bug by their opponent in terms of snap count again, 80 to 57 in this game. And then he still only plays 16 snaps. Go back to the Houston game, he played 38 snaps. The Kansas City game, he played 24 snaps when they needed him to do that. And he didn't play poorly. He played, you know, reasonably well that you know, you'd figure he would play more snaps. I don't have a good answer for why it would be true, but there's probably something relating to under what conditions they've decided preemptively that they want to get certain combinations on the field. And you know, depending on game script, you may just have to adjust from that. Because for instance, Peebles, we talked about, was a guy who played only 4 snaps in the game. You just can't afford to do that with only 4 active defensive linemen. It's too much wear on the big 4.
Yeah, agreed.
All right, my turn, right? Let's talk about Green. And Mike Green has been kind of an enigma this year. He's certainly, in recent weeks, I think he's looked better and twitchier in terms of what he brings to the pass rush. I think he's been more confident about putting his body in funny positions, I'll say, about stunting as needed to make a play. And I don't know whether I assume those decisions would be made from the sideline anyway, but he's typically an over guy, not an under guy. And more so I'll talk about the confidence coming when he's one-on-one against the tackle. I haven't really sat down and tried to analyze what I think is happening on a by snap move with regard to whether or not he's timing up his rush properly. That's something I'd really have to do during the off season, because it took quite a lot of time to really look at that on a play-by-play basis. But I think by the way, if anybody wants to do that outside and has time to do it, hit me up. I'd happily have you on the show to discuss your findings. I think that'd be a lot of fun. But anyway, I'm seeing a guy who's more confident, still losing the edge quite often. That happened in this game some. Orlando Brown was kind of too heavy for him over there, and he lost the edge some, even when it was like a kind of a straight up block. Orlando Brown was able to manipulate him into position to seal. it's unfortunate, but I think he is becoming a much bigger threat as a pass rusher than he was early in the year.
Yeah, I would hope that Green would be able to get around someone like Orlando Brown Jr. I think Orlando Brown has definitely lost a step, and he's a very big man. No way someone like rookie Mike Green is going to be able to go through Orlando Brown. You know, you're just not going to be able to push through that type of mass. But I don't know. I was hoping for him to be able to get around that weaker Bengals offensive line a little bit. I think he's getting better. And I think it would be interesting in the offseason if someone had time, like you said, Ken, to really look through his snaps each week and see how he's trending and changing. And, you know, ultimately, what does he need to do in the offseason to get that game better? Where does he need to work? Where does he need to get that positional coaching to ultimately become a better player next year? So, you know, this is rookie year. Anything he does is kind of icing on top, or, you know, the cherry on top of the sundae here. But very soon we're going to be counting on him, and frankly, you could say that time is already now, right? That we're really counting on him. So and you know, to the extent he can get better, we really need it. And you know, hoping for his pressures to continue to grow. All right, so next player I wanted to talk about was Roquan Smith. He had 7 defensive wins among the 11 tackle contributions that he had. As we mentioned in the first show, I don't think either of us really blame him for the play in which Yoshivas went over the top. We thought that was Malachi Starks just getting over a little too late. All in all, I think a pretty good game from Roquan. Sometimes I would like to see a little bit more splash, but you can't have splash every game. So, it seemed like a fairly solid effort.
Yeah, double whammy on that 29-yard touchdown pass, because Roquan dropped from the line of scrimmage and had to drag that seam against Yoshivas to cover him. That's a very difficult deep drop for an inside linebacker. And that is one of the drawbacks of having somebody drop from the line of scrimmage in a simulated pressure, is that you give away any chance that a linebacker has to kind of even shut down on the window or even threaten the window with a quarterback if they're dragging a seam. The play it reminds me of is the play that lost the Ravens their chance to go to the postseason in 2017, right? That was the 4th-and-12 play that Cincinnati had, where Dalton went to Boyd, I believe it was, for the 49-yard touchdown. And there they asked CJ Mosley to drag that seam, but he had to do it dropping from the line of scrimmage. So it's very similar. And he was supposed to keep that window small. They did some other things. You know, obviously they had other guys who were tough outs on that defense that they had to stop for less than a 12-yard gain. Who was the guy they had? I think he was number 25, kind of a scat back. But he was very effective, and he was the butt sniffer on the play. I mean, he lined up directly behind the left guard or the right guard, one of the two. On that play. And I'm trying to remember the guy's name. I think he's number 25 for the Bengals in 2017. That's my recollection of it. But he's a running back and a smaller guy who would have been might have reminded you of Ray Rice in terms of his size and athleticism and whatnot. But I it's driving me nuts that I can't remember the name.
Jeremy Hill?
No, it's not him. I might have the number wrong. That's obviously possible. If you have the Bengals list from that year, you probably could find it. I'll look it up while you're talking about the next player here. But Smith's play in the game was outstanding. So I generally I'm very positive on what he did during the game. Let's talk about Wiggins for a moment, because he had a really good first half before he left. He was on Chase for a lot of the game. He gave up, said 7 targets of him in that first half for 43 yards, which is not bad. Just over 6 yards per target. He gave up plays of 15, 14, and 13 yards. And I think those were, at least 2 of those were to Chase. And I have to go back and look at it to make sure of exactly who was catching these balls. But he didn't have a bad game at all. And then he also had 2 passes defensed. One of them looked like it was basically all the receiver dropping the football, and he kind of just came in after the ball had kind of already been dropped and hit him for what the Ravens official scorer called a a PD, but another one he had a nice a PD by the goal line, and that was Yoshivas, I believe, in the corner of the end zone right by the pylon. Mm-hmm. So good game from Wiggins, and then to see him limp off the way he did at the end of that first half was horrible. I didn't actually see the video of it until I got home and watched the game. We sit on the opposite sidelines. So I couldn't see him leaving, but what a nightmare if he misses a significant time.
Yeah, for sure. Moving on to Marlon Humphrey. I thought he had an okay day. Him on Ja'Marr Chase isn't always the most fair matchup these days. But glad to see Marlon back from the finger pin. But you know, as I watch Marlon play, you know, I try to look forward a little bit to the future, and you know, is his conversion to safety something that would happen, you know, something as soon as maybe next season? Or do you think maybe he has another season of corner still under his belt? And that's the first question. Second question, if you had to keep either Roquan or Marlon, is it becoming a more clear choice at this point?
I don't think it's becoming a more clear choice. Mm-hmm. I think they would, they'd probably love to keep them both, but both of them they're in the worst spot possible because most of the money is spent. So you can't look at this as $32 million of cap spent on Roquan, say, when all you have that you can possibly save is $7 million. The only decision you have left right now is to say, is he worth $7 million or not next year? I think both players probably are. I don't know if they can afford to keep both of them. There's only four players on the entire roster who are players they can cut and gain significant cap space from, or even really even meaningful cap space from.
And, Justice and, Hill, those yeah. Roquan, Marlon, and then who's the last one?
Yeah, there's one other who's a mid-range savings, Braddock Washington.
Yes.
Yeah, so those are the four. Anyway, by the way, it's Giovanni Bernard is the guy, number 26, yes. Not number 25. So.
Yep.
All right. Let's see, you brought up Roquan Smith. Do a couple more. I brought up Wiggins, didn't I?
Yep. And then I hit Humphrey.
And you hit Humphrey. There you go. Okay. We'll do one more, and then maybe we'll call it here. I'll talk about Buchanan. We'll leave Hamilton off this week because Hamilton gets the attention all the time. We always talk about him in every other way. But Buchanan, I thought, kind of was a little bit absent in this game. He was on the field a fair amount. He played, like you mentioned, 61 snaps out of the 83, so almost 75% of the snaps. But part of the issue is that does not seem to be getting to accumulating defensive wins in the same way. It was two of his six tackles were defensive wins. Didn't really felt like he made his presence felt as a coverage player, which has been a problem all year. And as they face better quarterbacks, I think it'll become more a problem that he gets picked on in that role. So if you face Mahomes in a playoff game, I mean, they're going to try and figure out ways to scheme up how to get Kelce crossing the zone where Buchanan might be covering him so they can take advantage of that, either behind him, in front of him, whatever it might be.
Yeah, I'm with you, Ken. I think that there may be some that have overrated this start by Buchanan over the first 12 or 13 weeks here. I do like him being out there. I do like him getting a lot of game reps and game tape. I think that'll really help for the future. But for someone who was on the field for 61 plays, really just didn't see him making any plays where it felt like he was really helping the cause. I mean, when you play 80 snap, when there's 80 snaps, like you said, a lot of people are going to rack up tackles, but not all tackles are the same, right? You really want those defensive wins. So bit of a you know, MIA game from Buchanan there, but nonetheless, 61 snaps. I think there's a lot to learn in those snaps.
Right. All right, we got some mailbag questions this week, and we'll kind of just alternate on these. I guess I'll start with the first one. I'm going to save the special teams question here for last, but let's go to Unborn Bigfoot. Appreciate the Reddit folks out there. Unborn Bigfoot is a Reddit handle. He says, what's been the impact of Draymond Jones from a schematic standpoint, and how is it freeing up their other edge rushers? Mike Green's impact seems directly correlated with his signing. Okay, so a couple things are going on here in terms of Draymond. I'll hit on one element and then hit on anything else you see. But Draymond is one guy they're not afraid to kick inside as the third outside linebacker when they put an extra outside linebacker on, which is now in a dime package where they only really have only one serviceable inside rusher, and that's Travis. Yep. So if they do have a second guy on the inside, and they've been using Simpson some as a standing guy, and he could be inside, outside, roves around a little bit, picks his spot kind of thing. That's not really the same thing, but if they got kicking a guy inside to really put his hand in the dirt, then it's been Draymond Jones.
Yeah, I've loved Draymond Jones. I think that he has played some defensive tackle in his day. He's played some edge in his day. I like the fact that he's a little bit bigger and stronger than, you know, some of the players that the Ravens have. He's bigger and stronger than Mike Green. He's bigger and stronger than Ajabo. He's older too, right? So he's got a little bit more of his man strength. Like the fact that he can kick inside. I actually think that he's the type of player where I'd love to have him back on the Ravens next year. So love the way he's played. And I think that, you know, you've seen a step up in play from Mike Green since he's come here. So really been happy with his play so far, and hoping we can get him for a decent deal, all things considered, and think he adds a lot to the team.
Yeah, if they don't sign somebody like that, it means draft capital will have to be expended, because there are really no other options inside the organization at this point. Kyle Van Noy is probably going at the end of this year. You've got Mike Green, who we hope will ascend. You know, obviously Ajabo is almost certain to be gone, I would think.
What do you think about Adisa Isaac, Ken? Anything there? Have you heard anything?
He'll be in his third year next year for starters. So that mm-hmm. right there is a problem. Yep. So do I want that to be the pony the Ravens bet on? Probably not. You have heard that Adisa Isaac apparently had a setback. They announced that this week, and is not going to be back this year. Or at least it sounds like it won't be back this year, because Harbaugh wouldn't put a time frame on it. I don't see it as likely that he'll be a guy they're depending on next year.
Terrible time in his career to have a setback, because he missed a lot of last year, missed this year. You know, even if he was able to come back for 7 games and, you know, get back in with the coaches and become relevant again, that would really help. But I think the Ravens have a handful of players who have missed some key development. The two rookie cornerbacks, Adisa Isaac, it's tough to see that.
Yeah, it is. Just trying to think about who else the Ravens have at outside linebacker. They have Cayman Rucker on the practice squad right now.
And Malik Cunningham.
And Tavius Robinson will be back. Mm-hmm. Tavius Robinson will be back. So, okay, that's their primary guys next year are going to be Tavius Robinson and Mike Green. Then they're going to have to build around that.
Yeah.
And Tavius Robinson will be a fourth-year player. So this is a point at which they have to decide, do they want to extend him? He's one of the big players they got to figure out this year, as opposed to letting him get closer to free agency. And maybe there's a deal to be made there. And I certainly hope that they're going to get the situation figured out with the current free agents they have, most notably with Travis Jones on the defense. All right. Do you want to take us to a second question here?
Yeah. Do you want me to hit the special teams question?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So this is from Lyman's Backpack on Twitter, also known as X. Lyman's Backpack says, Loop has the shortest kickoff distance in the NFL at 56.4 yards average. And the average ball landing spot is the 8.6 yard line. While the average return is middle of the pack at 20.6 yards, the short kicks lead to the near worst average starting position. Ken, why do you think that the team prefers this strategy?
Okay, so strategically, if the other option is kicking the ball into the end zone on the fly, that's the 35 yard line. That'd be a lot worse than the average starting field position. The average starting field position is probably right around the 30, maybe a little bit closer. It's made drive shorter in the NFL. This new dynamic kickoff mm-hmm. rule has made drive shorter. And the problem has basically been Loop's inaccuracy. He hasn't been able to get the ball into the landing zone at the proper spot as often. And it's okay to take a chance where you go between the 5 yard line and the -1, say, And 5 out of 6 times you're going to be in the field of play. And the 1 out of 6 times you're going to give up a touchback. And it's okay to do something like that. But you have to have that sort of accuracy, at least, I think, to be effective under the current kickoff rules. You can't be kicking it to the 10 or 15 yard line, you know, with any relative frequency, let's put it that way. But that hasn't been Loop's only problem. Loop's kicked the ball out of bounds. Loop's kicked the ball short of the landing zone multiple times this year. And that sets you up at the 40-yard line. So those things aren't acceptable, maybe to a greater degree. So I don't think it's a strategy. It's a matter of ability so far. And Tyler Loop's been a good field goal kicker. He just hasn't found the range in terms of the kickoffs yet.
Yeah, and look, this isn't something that they did in college, right? So this is new. I mean, if you look at the loft, the trajectory, what you're trying to do, it's different. I think he's just trying to adjust to it. And, you know, you could say their kickers just kick the ball. Well, he is kicking the ball, right? And he's just not doing that great of a job on these kickoffs. But I'm very, very happy with his field goal accuracy. And so pretty thankful there, but definitely something he needs to work on in the offseason. I think it's going to take more time, and it's going to be hard to do in season.
Randy Brown is a great kicking coach, by the way, and I'd love to hear what his thoughts were on how he tells Loop to center his aiming point on the kickoff. It's like, are you... Do you have to be more concerned about your left-right variation? Because I would think that would be very significant.
This Black Friday, get 6 months free when you move your WordPress sites to Kinsta. Enjoy faster load times, no stress when traffic spikes, and hosting you can actually count on. We're G2's number one rated host for WordPress. For a reason. Visit kinsta.com/BF. That's KINSTA.com/BF. Don't miss out. Offer ends December 2nd.
You know, you definitely want to have it to one side of the field is part of the thing. Trap the guy in the corner at the 1 yard line is obviously like the perfect place to kick a football if you can make it happen. And, you know, honestly, a lot of the kickers have been trying to skip the ball into the end zone by kicking it low and try to see if they can get it between two return men. And some of that's worked and some of it hasn't. But I think that can be good. Loop has tried it some, and he hasn't been real successful doing that. I think that's some of his short kicks have been of those type. But I'd love to hear like kind of the how do you coach someone to spot up or to target a particular spot on the field with regard to a kick, and how can he like calibrate his left-right miss percentage with his long short miss percentage. To try and optimize that in terms of where the ball lands.
Yeah, I do think it's a good question, Lyman's backpack. And, you know, they definitely lost the field position battle against the Bengals. And you lose the field position battle by, you know, 20 plus yards on average. You give the ball away 5 times, you're not going to win many of those games.
Yeah, and most of them were because they gave the ball away 5 times. I don't want to double count those, but yes, that's definitely true.
It was so painful, Ken. I feel like I don't even know if I considered double counting.
All right, got one more question. That's from Dustin. Not sure which show would be the best for this type of question, but I'm curious where you think Kyle Hamilton will rank by the end of his career in the pecking order of the Ravens' great defenders. Where does he stand currently? All right, well, give me your top three currently, because I'm sure they're going to be the same as my top three.
Yeah, I mean, it's Ray, it's Ed, it's Suggs, right? The obvious three. Haloti Ngata's probably getting up there at some point, but I don't think he supplants the big three.
And Haloti Ngata, honestly, though, probably is ahead of Hamilton currently because then there's a lot of players in there that you have to consider, even if they played for the Ravens for a short time in some cases. Like Rod Woodson was here 4 years, I think, in Baltimore. He's a terrific player. Chris McAllister, where does he fit on the list? I think you have to take a look at Michael McCrary. Peter Boulware certainly deserves consideration to be on there somewhere. He actually was quite flexible for where he played for the Ravens, whether they needed him at outside linebacker or defensive end. I'm trying to think of the other players who really fit in this category. Trevor Price might be another player who would still be ahead of Hamilton. I mean, Hamilton's got some players to pass with aggregate career performance yet before we put him in the place of those guys. And I understand you're asking us to project this. Mm-hmm. But very hard for me to project Hamilton into the top three, given how ascendant the Ravens' top three are.
Yeah, to me, it's you need to have a high peak and you need to have duration. And from Hamilton's perspective, he's definitely got some high level play, but he's got to do it over, you know, the next 6 to 8 years to really start getting in that conversation. And one of the things that worries me about him is the injuries. He's always banged up. He's always nicked up. Not that Ray Lewis and Ed Reed and Terrell Suggs, not that they didn't have injuries, but it wasn't anything close to the extent of on the field, off the field that we're seeing. And, that hinders Hamilton's impact. And again, that's why I was asking, is there a more optimal weight for him? What can we do to keep him on the field a little bit more? And I don't think weight's always the right answer, right? That doesn't necessarily fix everything, but I think it's a really good question. To me, it's 6 to 8 more years of very, very high level play. And you probably got to get a championship in there, right? Yeah. To really get people to remember your name. So do I think it could happen? Sure. I think it could happen. I'm not going to project it just yet. And to your point, Ken, even players that maybe were a little bit lesser, like CJ Mosley, Marlon Humphrey, right? There's a lot of players in there that were pretty good and, you know, had significant time on the team, right? That, you know, they've been here for a while. So there's a lot that Kyle has to do. I think he can do it. Do I think it's likely? I don't really know how to favor yes or no to that. But he needs a lot more.
Well, the good thing is he signed for the Ravens through 2030, right? I think now.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So that's fantastic. Okay. So great starting point. I think the chance of him making the Ring of Honor is extremely high based on who he is. But then I do look at the career of the player we've been comparing him to, which is Ted Hendricks. And Hendricks had a lot of injuries over the years, and he did make the Hall of Fame and had a remarkable longevity and as his career went, you know, playing from 69 to 83. What's amazing about Hendricks' career is the outlier things he did. Now, one thing the NFL does not have is they do not have good records of blocked punts career, but Hendricks, it has been reported for having between 7 and 10 career block punts. It turned out the NFL looked at it a few years ago and they looked at some of the individual block punts. They said, well, no, two of these were deflections. And so Steve Tasker with 9 is actually the guy who leads the NFL in career block punts. And I think a lot of Ravens fans, their first guess would probably be that it said Reed. But Hendricks is a remarkable player in multiple ways on a football field. And Hamilton, the things he shows in terms of being able to use his leverage are portable things that'll last him a good long time if he can remain healthy. Hendricks had some trouble staying on the field, but it did not kill his Hall of Fame candidacy. And if you look back at his 1971 season, it's one of the greatest all time by any defender. Top 15, I'll say, of all time. Just an absolutely ridiculous year where he had, I think, 5 or 6 interceptions. He had sacks. He's making plays all over the field for an absolutely fantastic Colts defense that fell to Miami in the AFC Championship game that year. But really great player. I think the chance of somebody like Hendricks, you know, taking that career path from where he was after 4 or 5 years, say, to finish up and be the player he was, it takes a lot of luck. And there's been players who, you know, certainly started out as great. Derwin James, I wouldn't predict him for the length of career necessary to challenge a player like Ed Reed for the greatest safety of all time, even though Derwin James may have been close to as great as Ed Reed was so far for portions of this. I don't want to betray Ed Reed in some way of saying that, but Derwin James has been a great safety.
Yeah, that's a great point, Ken. I looked up Ted Hendricks for the first time. 4 times he was AP one. Mm-hmm. 26 interceptions. Really, really interesting player. And like you said, 6'7", you know, 210 to 220 pounds. A very interesting build. It's almost like Reggie Miller from the Indiana Pacers out there.
Yep. It's a tall, not particularly muscular guy who really understood how to use leverage on a football field. So he was remarkable. All right, that'll have to do it for the mailbag for today. Really, really appreciate everybody sending in questions. Please keep sending them in, folks. Great stuff. Some of the highlights of the show is just talking about somebody else's ideas occasionally. And we love to have this kind of stuff. It could be historic, like we just had from Dustin, or it could be anything that's special teams, which we don't normally cover in either show. And it can certainly be anything related to franchise building. I'll usually save them for Friday Morning GM. And especially want to plug this right now. I'm looking for people to put in questions that would make a nice video short. And in particular, anything that I can explain how you do or how you get to that information or how it works within about 2 minutes is ideal for me to put in a video short. So I'll certainly give you credit when I put those out. Matt, the one question I'd like to finish here before we have to call this is, the Ravens are at this point in the season. Where do they go from here? What's the path that you see for the Baltimore Ravens from here?
Yeah, I would say it's very heavily dependent on Pittsburgh and what Pittsburgh does. I think that the Ravens are going to have to take one of the next two Pittsburgh games. They're going to have to take the next Cincinnati game, and they're going to have to split one of the games against Green Bay and New England. I'm not sure this team is consistent enough to do that. This team has a miraculous ability to have individual players fail each other on different plays. So it's not that one person or one player had an awful game. A lot of times it's, especially on the offensive line, this person had five bad plays, this person had five bad plays, this person had five bad plays, and so forth. And it basically ends up rotating where you have a very, very mediocre output because you always had someone missing. In this game, you had Lamar miss several throws. You had receivers drop several throws. You had the ridiculous turnovers. And where I see them going from here is either really pulling it together and getting more consistent across the ball, or, you know, finishing the season 2-3 or 3-2. So I think there needs to be a lot more consistency on this team in order for them to really make a push into the playoffs. Ken, what about you?
Yeah, they can win. They go to the playoffs if they go 2-3 the rest of the year, if their two wins come against the Steelers.
Right.
If they don't, they're going to have a very, very hard time getting there because the Steelers would have to win only. Well, they'd have to beat Cincinnati and the Steelers the next 2 weeks. Then they'd be pretty close to what they need for the division. But the Steelers mm-hmm. would still have to lose two more games. You could lose one to Buffalo. They've got other ones coming up as well. Miami, they might lose two. So it's certainly possible. Part of me says it might not be worth the draft pick to make the playoffs, but I can never bring myself to believe that as a fan. I always say get in the tournament. You might go far once you get there. They have certainly a group of superstar players that are certainly capable of any given Sunday or Saturday in the postseason. And I would love to see them have a chance to come through this year the way they did in 2012 with the team that was not the best. In fact, was the worst of the first five Harbaugh years that all made the playoffs. But the 2012 team was decidedly the worst in terms of DVOA. I always get some blowback on this. People say, oh, no, they had Bolden, they had so-and-so, and they didn't have Ray Lewis effectively for the entire year. When he played, he was terrible. And they had an aging Ed Reed on the team who was not the same player he'd been early in his career. They lost Lardarius Webb in the same week they lost Lewis for the season in Webb's case. And it wasn't nearly as good a football team as the other years around them. Also had a lot of offensive line problems that they addressed in the playoffs, but they still were not unbelievably great even then, where they had been very good at those positions a year before. I hope that this Ravens team has that sort of opportunity to be a get in the tournament and get hot at the right time and win. But I'll say this, so far, the Ravens of 2025, but one of the really troubling things is they haven't been particularly good against good teams. So they've beaten the Bears. That was a nice win. But their other wins, you know, the only win they had in the first 6 weeks of the season was against Cleveland. That's not terribly impressive. And you look at the winning streak they've had otherwise, they've done a pretty good job of the other teams that they've played playing well around those games, but they haven't generally been against teams that have been winning either.
Yeah, exactly. And so they're going to have to turn that around. I mean, it looks like they're going to be potentially playing Mason Rudolph without DK Metcalf. So I don't know. The time is now, Ken. The time is now. You got to go out there. You got to start winning these ball games. And winning ball games does not start with five turnovers. It's that simple.
All right. Couldn't agree more, Matt. And it's great talking football with you. Tell folks where they can catch up with you online if they want to talk or include you in a conversation.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at 20KidRock. Thanks, Ken.
All right. Other folks out there, thanks for listening as always. Please make use of hashtag Film Study Mailbag for your questions. And if you want to do us a favor, write us a 5-star, 50-word review on your favorite podcast platform, or tell that one new person who isn't aware of the program that they might enjoy it. Thanks very much for listening. And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.